some sort of electronic time so you know it's not just my watch. Okay, welcome back to this afternoon. Fascinating morning, and now we'll follow up with the panel discussion. So again, the cards, if you have questions that you haven't written yet, write them on down, legibly please, so I don't mangle your question and then pass it to the side, okay? But I have a whole list of questions to get started on. But before we do that, can I ask, please, because there we have a couple of people who weren't speaking this morning, if we can just start from the corner, Monique, introduce yourself and where you're from. And you got to push, push a button to turn the red light on. Yes.
Oh, okay. Hi, I'm Monique Williams, and I'm a graduate student from the University of California, Riverside.
Hi, my name is Cliff Watson. I'm from the Centers for Disease Control, and I run the tobacco products lab.
Good afternoon. I'm Mike Ogden with RAI Services Company in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Scientific and regulatory affairs for all of the Reynolds family of operating companies, which includes R.J. Reynolds Vapor Company.
I'm Maciej Goniewicz. I'm from Rand Institute.
My name is Gene Gilman. I'm the Laboratory Director for Enthalpy Analytical. We're a large CRO located in Durham, North Carolina, and we do business with traditional tobacco companies, e-cigarette companies, and device manufacturers.
I'm Konstantinos Farsalinos. I'm a physician and researcher at Onassis Cardiac Surgery Center and University of Patra in Greece.
I'm Tom Eisenberg from Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, Virginia.
All right, thank you. Dr. Gonovitz, first one up to you. And this one, if you can remember your slides, a question about one slide, comparing the toxicants from e-cigs and combusted cigarettes when you were comparing.
Yes, for the purpose of this comparison, we compare the amounts that we found in 15 puffs. So at that time when we did the study, we thought that this might be some kind of the way to comparing. So we compare the amounts found in 15 puffs with the amounts found in one cigarette. It has some limitations, you know, that this type of method, when we are trying to compare different products, you know, what is the equivalent in terms of number of puffs with the equivalent to smoking one cigarette. There might be alternative approaches. Maybe we can compare per nicotine. So the amount of the toxin per milligram of the nicotine delivered. There might be ways to looking at the hundred of puffs from electronic cigarette. Please remember that these are the laboratory studies when we are testing the products with the smoking machine in a certain conditions. And I think that the next step, what we really have to look is the actually uptake and exposure among the users. And this will give us more detailed information about the exposure, because the way that people are using these products and the amount of the vapor and the toxicants they inhale, and we can find these levels in the body or looking at the biomarkers of exposure, biomarkers of harm, and comparing these biomarkers with the levels of biomarkers in the smokers, it will give us a better estimation than just looking at the vapor.
Okay. All right, this is for the whole panel. Do any of the presenters have any data on the number or percent of e-cigarette devices in countries outside of the U.S. So we've been hearing about the U.S. today. Do you all know about how many e-cig devices are in countries outside the U.S.? And if so, where are those e-cigarettes manufactured and where are the e-liquids manufactured?
I can answer if you want. 90%, I would say 95% of the e-cigarette devices are manufactured in China. Therefore, most likely the same number of different devices are both in the U.S. market and elsewhere, let's say, for example, Europe. E-liquids On the other hand, there are many, many companies, both in Europe and in the U.S., a large number of companies, who are manufacturing the e-liquids in places outside China. Of course, there are also some big manufacturers in China. Maybe most of the raw materials come from China also, like nicotine or flavorings, but there are many domestic, especially in the U.S., we're talking about probably thousands of e-liquid manufacturers who are mixing their own liquids and provide them to the market. But for the devices, the vast majority of the commercial sector, I mean the large-scale production, is coming from China.
All right. Regarding the presentation on nettles in aerosols, all of the data and testing is on cartomizers. Most tank systems used today have no fiber materials beyond silica wicks, have no soldering. I always have a problem with that L in soldering. Soldering. The tank is glass, and the only metals used are stainless steel and the Kentel wick. So are you planning on testing any of those products?
I'm actually having data analyzed on that as we speak, so I can't really speak on that just yet. But I do expect to be a different concentration of metals in these tank models. Now, what those are, I'm not entirely sure just yet, but coming soon.
I can make a comment on that. We already have data that, depending on the equipment, we see different levels or presence or even absence of metals. I'm sure that Dr. Gonievich did a study and was published in 2013, and he analyzed 12 metals. He found only three. On the other hand, Dr. Williams found a large number of metals in some other devices, mainly cartomizers. In my opinion, what is important in these cases, of course, you expect that there will be some metals into the cartomizer or into the liquid. It's a metallic structure, the e-cigarette device. What matters is what is the comparative level, because just the presence of anything doesn't define toxicity. Principle in toxicology, that toxicity is defined by the amount of exposure, not just by the presence or absence of something. So we know that if we do an analysis of water, heavy metals, this doesn't mean that this is dangerous. So, interestingly enough, our team analyzed the data from Dr. Williams, and we compared. She had a table of a large number of metals and the detection level at per 10 puffs, if I remember well, yes? So we assumed, based on the fact that an average vapor from service takes about 600 puffs, we assumed that they take 1,200 puffs. And we measured the total daily exposure based on the results from Dr. Williams. And what we did was we compared those numbers with established safety limits. For example, for five of the metals, we had data from permissible daily exposure from inhalational medications from the U.S. Pharmacopoeia. The worst case for e-cigarettes was nickel, which was three times lower exposure compared to the acceptable limit from medications. Then, for manganese, we used the minimal risk levels from ATSDR. It was six times less the e-cigarette exposure compared to the MRL of the ATSDR. And for the rest, the only data we found was from NIOS, the recommended exposure levels. And the difference was from 380 times to 46,000 times lower exposure from e-cigarette use compared to the limits of the acceptable safety limits. So I think that in every case, and I agree with Dr. Gonievich, it is important to provide a comparative measure. We know that there are problems with comparing puffs from e-cigarette with puffs with one tobacco cigarette or whatever. But we must do something. I mean, just the presence of something doesn't mean that it's dangerous. And I think it's important for the public health community to understand what's the level of exposure from what we're finding. Thank you.
It's a panel discussion, so we can have discussion from anybody else, too.
Just to follow up with that, it was a very good point, and I did actually read your blog on that online. And it is a very good point that the concentrations that we did report are much lower than the minimal risk levels that have been provided by government for the government safety standards. But one thing to note is that you're not just being exposed to manganese or tin or silica. You're being exposed to a combination of all of those. And there is no government standard for a combination or such complex mixture. And I think that should be addressed.
I agree with you. And that's why, since there is no interaction, specific interaction between two materials, you cannot just add the exposure, adding the percentage compared to the safety limit. And even if you add it, you don't get any level of concern. I'm not saying that it's absolutely safe. So it's a very nice opportunity to say that the e-cigarette is not an absolutely safe product. And of course, it should not be used. So, however, considering the devastating effects of tobacco cigarettes, we must have a comparative measure for e-cigarettes.
So this is a sort of a follow-up question. Have you compared the metal levels to the health impacts and daily exposure levels such as NIOSH?
Dr. Forst?
I think we just mentioned that.
I think we just talked about
that. Consider that one answered. Thank you.
Yeah, if I can comment, I try to put this on my presentation, and I know there are some controversies about using the occupational standards for assessing health risk from tobacco cigarettes. It was used, and now it can be used for electronic cigarettes. Please remember that the exposure is the function of the dose, but it's also the time of exposure. And what we are talking right now, we are talking about the users who will be using these products for a long time. And it's not just a single exposure. It's not just exposure for 8 hours and nothing less. And, of course, there will be cumulative exposure to many toxicants. And so I don't say that this is the wrong way to do this. This is the one of the way we should look at the data, but not the only one. And the other thing I want to point to the comments before, that we still see the huge variation among the products in this, whatever we look, whether we look at the metals, whether we look at the other toxicants. So we know that these products are generally safer, they are safer than less harmful than tobacco cigarettes, there's no doubt. But there is some continuum of risk among the products. And if there is the possibility to reduce the risk, even if the exposure is negligible, why not eliminate this exposure? Why not make it as low as possible? And why to provide the users advice about the product, which actually might be more dangerous than the alternative product on the market? So we might challenge this problem that, we know that the group of these products, it's much safer than tobacco cigarettes, period. But among the products, we might have some kind of variations, and how to assess this variation, how to implement the standards for the products and reduce the risk, even if it's negligible.
I absolutely agree with Dr. Gonyevich, and I believe, to tell you the truth, and some people from the industry here may not like it, that cartomizers like the one that Dr. Williams examined should be extinct from the market. I know that there are many big companies using cartomizers, but it's probably the worst case scenario in terms of the atomizer material and quality. I absolutely agree. If there is an avoidable risk, it should be removed. We published a study with diacetyl and acetylpropionyl. We identified a significant risk, which was less than smoking, but still, it is an ingredient. If you can avoid it, you should avoid it at any cost. I absolutely agree.
Okay. What device control could be used, and how effective is such control to manage potential consumer exposure to undesirable substances in e-cig aerosols, such as the coil temperature, the puff duration, operating time? So what device control could be used, and how effective would such control be?
I have two things on that. So to go back to the original question, I think that what we're looking at today are devices that were manufactured in a vacuum. There was no concern about metals in the aerosol, no concern about transfer. There has been no vast majority of manufacturers, especially small manufacturers, to improve their products. We're starting to see that now with some of the advanced devices that are titanium or pure stainless steel with no solder joints, and those are going to make a really big impact on metals levels. But until we get the information back to the people that are actually making the devices that this is a problem, then they don't have a chance to fix it. And if we can communicate that information back to China where they're actually soldering these things together and maybe using the inappropriate amount of solder, the inappropriate assembly process, we'll probably see those numbers drop significantly once they're aware that there's an issue. So I think we have some responsibility to communicate that back to the people that are assembling the products, not necessarily the users of the products, but put it back on the manufacturers. And that kind of goes back to the next question, is that we are starting to see devices that are designed to limit constituents. We have temperature-controlled devices that are on the market. We have devices that are made out of pure titanium, pure stainless steel, pure glass, that have eliminated many of the problems we see in the devices that we're actually talking about today. And if we had data on these relatively new devices, we would probably find that these dangerous levels would be either greatly reduced or not detectable.
I can comment on that.
Wait a second. Let me get Dr. Ogden in.
Well, actually, the comment I was going to make is a nice follow-up to Gene's comment. I think the device control should start with the device design. I mean, there are a number of design features that are inherent to all of the products. And if that's taken into proper consideration, where you consider, you know, the availability of voltages or currents, but also the availability of the wicking solution, you know, into the heated zone, the ability of the device to shut off if it runs dry. I mean, those are basic design parameters that I think, if they're properly designed at the beginning, would address many of those concerns as well.
And let me get Dr. Watson.
Just sort of that same thought. You know, the two different types of products that are out there, or more than two, but sort of the disposable items, which presumably are manufactured to be, you know, the least costly because they're sort of, you know, one-time use, the battery dies, the e-solution runs out, you throw it away. I mean, that's kind of a self-limiting use in terms of, presumably if it was manufactured in a cleaner manner. But for the other ones, sort of the reusable ones, I think it would be good at some point down the road to have some sort of recommendations about sort of, you know, life of the product, or maybe there's consumer feedback. I don't use an e-cigarette product, but maybe over time you can tell that the product's degrading, it's time to upgrade and replace. And I think these are points that need to be addressed and people need to be aware of. You know, there needs to be some sort of product life, as was mentioned this morning, about what are sort of the shelf lives and sort of when do these products sort of reach the end of their service life, useful service life. And I think we don't know those answers at this point.
I want to come back to the question that was posed about the coil temperature, if I remember well. So we may at some point be able to define what is the best material that is not exposing us to anything, the best liquid in terms of composition, but the temperature of evaporation is, I think, the most important factor, and until now, it is an uncontrollable factor. However, there are technologies that are coming, and some of them are already on the market recently, with the ability to limit the temperature of evaporation and for the user himself to be able to set an upper limit of temperature of evaporation. And there are technologies which will come in the near future, probably, that will avoid completely the use of any heat source, will avoid the use of any coil material, and we are going to see, I think, a revolution over the next years with e-cigarettes. It is important for any regulation to allow this revolution to come because it is a vast improvement in safety.
You're consistent in that message, sir. Okay, so this follows up sort of on what you were talking about, the temperature, though. So it says, which chemical constituents of e-liquids and e-cigarette aerosols are the principal drivers of potentially harmful effects? So this is going separate from temperature, is saying what are the chemical constituents of e-liquids and e-aerosols that are the principal drivers of potentially harmful effects?
So the data I presented, you know, we know that, I just want to mention that it will be also answered to this question, that we, with the temperature, the problem, and we heard this today, is that if we try to limit the temperature to some low level, we might challenge the efficacy of vaporization of nicotine. So it's not just reduce as low as we can, because then the product will be not effective in delivering nicotine. So what is the limit that we can avoid generation, like overheating of the product, but still the product will be effective in delivering nicotine. So talking about the other sources, so the temperature and the solvent are the sources of some volatile compounds. The traces of the nitrosamines might come from either nicotine or the flavor, the tobacco flavor in the product. And I think what we don't know right now, and I think this is really challenging, is the toxicity effect of the flavors. Because we are dealing with the hundreds of different flavors, and many of them were tested for the food industry, the fragrance industry, cosmetics. We don't really know what's going on in electronic cigarettes when they are heated, they are inhaled, and again they are inhaled for many years. So I'm waiting for this session on the toxicological assessment of the product, because this is something what is really challenging, and I see the great potency here to make the product as safe as possible.
I think that just covers one other question. Any other comments? Go ahead, please.
I do have one. I mean, if you look at the overall toxicity profile of an e-cigarette, I think the key considerations that you'd want to take into account are the actual ingredients that are put into the product, the level of use, and their toxicity profiles. But do you also have to consider the impurities and the contaminants that are in those ingredients and their toxicity profiles as well? Some of that was touched on this morning, the importance for, you know, specifying a minimum purity grade, USP, or things of the like. But I think you also have to consider, back to some of our earlier conversation, is the heat profile of the product itself and the ability or the potential there for those ingredients to decompose. So I think it's a combination of factors, and I think you would those factors in different ways as you design and evaluate the product.
Just take a slightly different attack with that. I don't think that there's a whole lot of danger with the devices that we have on the market right now. What I think is devices and liquids being manufactured by people who have no idea what they're doing. And that's really where we are in the U.S. There are people who manufacture liquids in their house and sell them consignment in vape shops. There are people who manufacture devices and sell them to other people. I could literally go to China and make my own e-cigarette and have it sold in a convenience store in the United States. Regulations on me whatsoever. I can control the amount of nicotine that's put into my products, and if I don't know what I'm doing, I can very easily put in 100 milligrams of nicotine into the device instead of 10. And those things have happened. I can use propylene glycol, or ethylene glycol. I can use ethylene glycol in my liquids instead of PG and glycerin that are approved. I can use non-USP grade diluents. I can use pesticide grade nicotine. There are no safety controls on what can be sold in the U.S. right now, and the responsible manufacturers are taking steps to make sure their products are quality products. But there are many, probably thousands of people who don't have the training or background to manufacture products like that.
Thank you. Tom, are you?
Yeah, I'm interested in that comment you made at the beginning of that statement. I don't believe that there's anything wrong with the products that are being sold today. It was something like that. I'm focusing on the I don't believe part, because I think that the people who then you discuss who are selling products that may be dangerous, they would make the same statement. I don't believe there's anything wrong with the products that I'm selling right now. And both of you are making faith-based statements, and I think what we're here to do is to help inform FDA, which is interested in making data-based statements, not faith-based statements. And so I'm not impressed with I don't believe, although in fact I do believe some of the products out there are dangerous right now, but I'm not impressed with my belief, I'm impressed with the data. And I haven't seen any data to show that the products that are out there right now are not dangerous over the long term.
I guess what I meant by that is with the samples that we've seen in our laboratory, and we have over 200 active customers, we've tested probably 5,000 vapor samples in the last year, and the samples that we're seeing all seem to be very reasonable and consistent and don't make me go, this has got to come off the market. But I am aware of products that come in where people, they're mislabeled. Somebody will send in a nicotine sample to be tested and it's 12 milligrams of nicotine and it's actually 120. Those cause me a lot of concern. That doesn't happen very often, but it is real and it's on the market. And if you look long enough and hard enough, you will find those exemptions. And those are the things that really concern me. In my opinion, I'm not a toxicologist, you know, the risk benefit to normal e-cigarettes versus combustible cigarettes, I think is pretty clear. So that's what I meant by that.
Well, I'll clarify my comment. I wasn't at all saying that the results you were getting weren't consistent or weren't unexpected. Take propylene glycol, for instance. I imagine you're seeing propylene glycol in the vapors that you're analyzing, but I haven't seen a single study, and I'm aware of the ones that were done in the 1940s of exposing animals to ambient propylene glycol. I haven't seen a single study that tells me the long-term, that is 20 to 30-year safety of 100 or 200 puffs of propylene glycol every day for that period. And until I do, I'm not comfortable with the statement, I don't believe that they're safe, or I don't believe that they're unsafe. I think what we need is some data that address simply the basic issue of what we expect to be in the aerosols. I'll just end by saying that I think the goal of electronic cigarettes, as I understood it, was to deliver physiologically active nicotine to the lung. And if that's the goal, then we ought to be asking those products to do exactly that. And if they're going to deliver something else to the lung, there ought to be a reason for it and a safety profile for it.
We hear very, very frequently the issue of the long-term effect, which I absolutely agree. It is impossible to know right now what's going to happen after 30 years of inhaling propylene glycol. So what should we do? I mean, we have to reply. What should we do? Remove the products and wait for 30 years? Okay, if we remove the products from the market, who is going to use them for 30 years to know? One is that. Secondly, for medications, have you ever seen a medication being marketed after 30 years of use in humans? When statins were marketed, it was expecting 30-year studies for statins because statins are used for 20 or 30 or even more years. My brother is using statins from the age of 25 for 20 years now. So the argument that we don't have long-term effects is correct, but it doesn't mean that we should restrict the products. We should be cautious, I absolutely agree. We should wait to see on the population level, but the only way of seeing that is by having people use it.
And our third workshop will be on the population health effects, so we'll probably come back to that question too. Okay, so this comes back to some of the questions about particle size. Can flow rate affect particle size of the aerosol? If so, should delivery of nicotine versus flow rate be investigated? Can flow rate affect particle size of the aerosol?
I mean, just some sort of general principles. I mean, particularly in cigarette smoke, and I assume e-cigarette aerosol behaves in a similar fashion, you have this phenomenon where the particles want to sort of glom together. So a lower flow rate, in theory, would give the particles more time to interact and sort of glom together. And so you may start off with a lower distribution of particle size, which over time might involve in sort of shift up to higher particle size distribution. I'm not sure. Maybe someone else here in the room has actually done some work on this, and they can confirm that it's indeed the case. That is what happens with cigarettes. And so in theory, flow rate could have some influence, and of course the design of the atomizer and the path link and all that would play a role too on the final distribution that the end user sees.
In the study that I put out last year, we did look at certain particles and the sizes of them, and there were some particles that we actually found that were really large. And we think that might be due to the airflow that was used to generate the aerosol, and as we learned today, that actually increasing the airflow rate could cool the aerosol faster and then have the particles condense, where you could get more larger particles with that. So that could explain the particle size, or at least for the larger ones.
I tend to agree with Thomas Eisenberg's study, which showed that airflow didn't have an effect on aerosol yield, on nicotine production, nicotine yield, and also on aerosol production. I mean, you didn't have any higher particulate matter yield, measured. And it makes sense because, you know, evaporation is happening only at the time of activation of the device. Unlike smoking, where when you're taking a harder puff for a larger volume, you accelerate the burning process of the cigarette. I think that Thomas's results make absolutely sense. I can also tell you that by doing some experiments in which we are measuring the coil temperature in real time and under realistic conditions, I mean with the atomizer fully assembled and used by experienced users, the airflow doesn't play a very big role in temperatures of evaporation as long as you have some airflow. So when you don't have you have no airflow at all, the temperature goes sky high very easily. When you have some airflow, it doesn't matter if it's 30 milliliters in 2 seconds or 60, the difference is much lower. It may be 10, 20 degrees centigrade. However, when you don't have no airflow at all, it may go higher by 90 or 100 degrees centigrade, Celsius, I mean. So I tend to agree with Thomas' results.
All right, so following up in flow rate, particle size was linked to toxicity based on the talks this morning. Is there composition of the liquid or the particle size more important concern? So is it the composition of the liquid or the particle size that's more important concern?
So in my understanding, again, I'm a chemist, very simplistic view of the world. There's no direct link between the size of the particles and the toxicity per se. The difference is that the smaller particles have, there's more chance for things that are in the particles to escape and to evaporate, and presumably due to the deeper penetration into the lung spot of particle size, you can get more transfer in from the particles into the people. So it's not necessarily the size of the part increasing toxicity, it's basically making a more effective means to deliver things into the body. Answer there.
There is a lot of misconception in this subject, and I absolutely agree with you. Let's clarify something. We know from data from environmental studies, environmental pollution studies, and from cigarette smoke, that yes, the smaller the size of the particle, the more toxic it is. But all these particles are environmental pollution or tobacco cigarette smoke particles, which means that in most cases are combustion products. So when you have a toxic particle, yes, size matters. In this case with the e-cigarette, toxic micro droplets of propylene glycol, glycerol, nicotine, and so on. So it's a matter of difference in the composition. Of course, if something is toxic, yes, the smaller the size, the more the toxic effects. But we should not compare the studies of environmental pollution when size really matters with exposure to another type of aerosol in terms of composition.
My previous comment, I was thinking about sort of organic droplet size. I mean, in theory, I suppose the work that Dr. Williams is doing could inform us on sort of the inorganic materials. If we're talking about inorganic particle size, I mean, there could, I guess, be some relation to toxicity. If these things sort of, penetrate into the cells or the cell walls and, may not themselves be toxic, but may cause some sort of inflammatory processes to occur, which could affect other processes, other things being absorbed, you could have some, there could appear to be some toxic effect to the particle size. I think that refers, at least in my simple way of thinking, more to the inorganic compound or particles.
And a lot of the health effects that have been reported so far with using electronic cigarettes have all revolved around some type of inflammation or irritation of the lung. How these particles in the aerosol affect the body, that link is kind of there, that it's these particles that are present that might be, composed organic as well, that could get into the body and possibly even the defense mechanisms. So possibly that could be what's happening within in the aerosol.
But this one, this is Dr. Gonowitz. Would PEG have less toxic degradants than PG or glycerin?
All these free solvents are considered to be safe, as industry or drugs or pharmaceutical preparations. I think the question would be, what about the degradation products? And actually, as I remember, the single product that was PEG-based, so had a PEG as a solvent for nicotine. And with just this one product, we did not see any significant elevation on the formaldehyde and acetaldehyde. So it would suggest that for the degradation byproduct, for the thermal degradation, these solvents would be more stable. So again, when we are talking about the toxicity in this group of product, among the different types of electronic cigarette with the different solvents, Yes, probably the solvent. We know that the PG and VG might affect the toxicity, might affect the degradation byproducts. So PEG sounds, there are very limited data, but it looks like it's more resistant to the thermal degradation.
If I follow up on Dr. O'Donnell's point, I think, again, you the choice of a solvent there, whether it's PEG or PG or glycerin, I mean, it impacts the liquid physical characteristics of the product. So it may not be an inherent chemical stability. It may be an enhanced performance of the system in keeping the wick wet, not running dry, you know, the wicking configuration. So if all of that is optimized, I mean, maybe there would not be a difference. But if you get into a situation where you might be using a physical design that's optimized for glycerin and you put a PG or a PEG solution into it, then all bets might be off. You might have degradation products where it wouldn't be expected with the system as designed.
I think that goes back to what Samantha was saying this morning about who knows what you start mixing together when you start interchanging the materials. Okay, this is not a trick question. Do data support that nicotine or other major ingredients in e-liquids should be produced to a specific standard or purity? Does data support that the nicotine or major ingredients in e-liquids should be produced to a specific standard or purity?
I think that the first study done in 2009 by FDA showing the traces of ethylene glycol, it was the first study, and it clearly indicates that there is impurity there coming from the solvent, and there is no doubt that this compound is highly toxic. So if we have a standard for the solvent, if we have a standard for purity of the nicotine, I mentioned that the nicotine solutions for the product, what if there is a toluene solution, the nicotine is dissolved in the toluene, which we can buy for the laboratory purposes. And so I think that the purity standards for the components, for the ingredients of the e-liquid ingredients of electronic cigarettes are quite important, and we cannot say no.
There is no doubt there should be standards, but there are already standards. United States Pharmacopoeia and European Pharmacopoeia purity nicotine, PG and VG, exist. So I think that should be the only choice for the manufacturers of e-liquids, nothing less. Now, yes, we have seen unfortunate cases of ethylene glycol being used instead of propylene glycol, probably, at huge levels, up to 70%, which is unacceptable, of course. But, I mean, it must be made clear. We don't need ingredients. The already established standards by the pharmacopoeia are very, very good. The only problem is, and I agree with what Matthew said before, is flavorings. The only standard that we have is the food flavoring, the food grade purity, which is not good enough for inhalation, so we don't know what's happening with flavors.
I think
that I, in the spirit of agreement, I agree with you there. that There, first of all, should be standards for the base ingredients. It sounds like there are, so that's great. I'm very interested in standards for the combination, and I'm uncertain why it is we would say, well, since every one of these 100 agreements, 100 individually, we should then combine them all together willy-nilly and then let them be aerosolized and inhaled. So I think we're in agreement on this point.
That's right.
Well, I think the at least in our experience, the chemical identity of an e-cigarette aerosol is largely dictated by the chemical composition of the e-liquid. And I'll use Cliff's disclaimer. I'm a chemist. But if you use ingredients or if you have impurities in any dairy ingredients, that those impurities are more likely to transfer to the aerosol, and you're more likely to detect them analytically. So I think there is evidence for that. The essence of your question, however, might have been one about toxicity, and that's a different question. But I think there is evidence that the purity or the impurities of materials going into the e-cigarette, it does translate into detectability of those constituents in the aerosol.
There is one risk for the regulation, and I have to add to what Thomas said in complete agreement once again, that, you know, if you just focus on every single component separately, you may miss the point, because no one is using every component separately. Everyone is combining different components in the final liquid. So we may have a regulation in which we ask to quantify every single component of the e-liquid and then check the toxicity risk profile of each component. But I think that the regulation should be more into evaluating the product as a whole, the liquid as a whole, the whole combination of these, the mixture of all these chemicals together, because this is exactly what the end user is using.
That the standards for the ingredients is just the part of the solution, and then the standards of the product, the standards for the manufacturing process, the standards for the packaging, and everything should be led by science, but aim is, I think we are thinking about the consumers of this product. You know, how to provide the safest products as possible. If it is possible, we should follow this road.
So to follow on that, what strategies can be used to evaluate the impact of manufacturing processes and device material on the use of e-liquid quality? So what strategies could be used to evaluate combinations of the components of them, how it's made, so the manufacturing process and device material on the quality of the product? So what strategies could be used in this myriad of combinations?
Well, if I understand the question correctly, and I will, may not, the idea of the predictive model that I was trying to explain, strategy, that is, it would be really great before even a product on the drawing board is turned into a sample product, if somebody were to say, well, let's take all the parameters and put them in this model so we can predict, in my case, what's going to come out the mouth end, but perhaps there are other things that you might want to predict. And I think we're well on our way towards that mathematical model with what's going to come. I honestly don't understand why what we're allowing is for people to come up with that whatever device and liquid combination they happen to glue together in their basement and then start selling it, when we could instead put some science behind it and find out what that product glued together is likely to do before it's even glued together.
One of my concerns, and when I meet people at some of the vape shows, they have their modified devices, is they've modified it in such a way that it's no longer a normal device. It's very high wattage, very high voltage, very high yield. We've heard comments about the vape Olympics where people blow these huge clouds. But if we had standards for typical normal devices that had X amount of wattage that yielded X, mils of nicotine or liquid a day, a bottle of liquid that contains X number of milligrams of nicotine, so the consumer has instant feedback of how much nicotine to put in a day with, they can do the math and instantly calculate what their yield is. And it's very difficult to do with cigarettes or smokeless tobacco. It's automatic. And if we can get to the point where we say to consumers, this is the amount of nicotine that's probably very reasonable to consume, thermally decompose the liquid and produce, you know, propylene oxide, formaldehyde, ethylene oxide, acrylic. Acetone, things of that nature. Procedures in place to make sure that the liquids that they're getting are the safest that are possible.
Just to sort of pick up on that, totally ring out on this. There are no other industries that do similar type device that have worked on similar problems for years, and so there are some guidance in other industries. There is a for packaging that came up with grade solvents and nicotine, and making sure basically you have quality starting materials as best you can. In terms of manufacturing, I mean, there's you know, following good manufacturing processes, GMP, and also having, you know, ISO manufacturing process to try to ensure, you know, quality products are being manufactured, and things like, you know, switching a drum of PG for diethylene glycol or something like that should never happen. I mean, there are industry standard practices out there that could be adapted, I think, very easily to the manufacture of e-cigarettes to try to ensure, you know, as good as quality as possible. And I think right now, in lieu of evidence, we need to sort of err on the side of being cautious, because we don't really know what the long-term health consequences or low-level contaminations are. And so we need to make a reasonable, good faith effort, I think, to provide the best quality products that are out there for the consumers using to minimize population harm.
I think if I understood the question correctly, I think the answer I would offer is the best place to start is sort of a gatekeeping control of the incoming materials. I mean, whether it's the e-liquid, the component of the e-liquids, or whether it's structural materials or packaging or whatever, you should begin there. You know, QA assessments of the incoming material, thorough toxicological evaluation, disclosures of ingredients and whatever would be in that material. I think that, and that's the practice that we adopt, all of the materials and chemicals and packaging before we would use it is thoroughly evaluated by board certified toxicologists. So I think you start there, and then, as you know, other questions can emerge in terms of manufacturing capability and stability, and those are different questions, but I think you should start with first principles and control the incoming materials.
If I can add something, I think that some of the strategies that like I mentioned on my presentation are easy to implement, and I don't see that they would harm the industry, the small manufacturers, and they will not harm the consumers. If required, like the extensive toxicological testing, if we start to require the long-term clinical data, then we are dealing with the problem that either tobacco industry of this product, and I know they are pros and cons this strategy, but we need to remember the product evaluated over the year without any regulation, and so we don't want to stop the evaluation of the product. We would like to see the improvement in the product, improvement in the safety, improvement in a customer demand, or, you know, appeal to the smokers that they actually want more and more switch to the safer product. But I would not like put too much to stop the process, to limit the for example the evolution of the product to something better and something safer.
And I just want to add that, they're all very good points, and I do believe that manufacturers do take what we research scientists do put out, and they do try to improve their product, which is why electronic cigarettes have been evolving over the years. And I've done a lot of graduate students, so I have actually seen the evolution of these products, and when, you know, research is put out there, you know, a lot of it's taken negatively, but some of it is taken positively. Like, I've seen a change in, like, the cartridges have been sealed, you know, better so there isn't much leakage. And, you know, it's gone from, like, the single atomizer to combining it into the cartomizer, and now it's into these tanks that have much smaller coils. So, you know, they're taking, you know, manufacturers are taking what's being said and, you know, putting it in the market. Devices are here to stay, and so I think there should be some type of regulation on, like, the design on the fluid, so that way it could potentially make a safer product.
I absolutely agree that there is a lot of room for improvement, but, you know, the trick with the regulation is fine balance between a small level of acceptable risk and huge acceptability of the product by the users. As Maciej said previously, I absolutely agree with him. For example, I have a device with me which can be set at 150 degrees Celsius, and it can work without delivering any carbonyl compounds to the user. But if I give this device to 10 vapers, they will all go and buy a pack of tobacco cigarettes because they cannot vape. So go for the maximum possible safety by sacrificing acceptability of the product by the smokers.
Other comments? Okay, so this question changes a little bit direction. What laboratory do you collect cigarette aerosols for constituent testing? So it changes the direction a bit. So what laboratory method do you use to collect e-cigarette aerosols for constituent testing?
I think we don't know the direct answer right now, because the studies that we've done and the other research has done, we use a different methods to collect the samples for analytical purposes. We should not only look at the particulate. So the Cambridge filter is the one, the standard method for testing tobacco cigarette tar. The tar from tobacco cigarettes is one of the methods we can trap the droplets of the aerosol with the paper filter pad. But we will be missing the volatiles, because they might pass the filter. So the same way, we are not looking for cartridge filter because it's a gas. So I think we need to apply the different strategy for testing the product depending on what we are looking for. If we are looking for volatile compounds, it must be the method for trapping volatile compounds. If we are looking for something that is in a droplet, it must be the method for looking for something that is dissolved. And also we discussed the standard protocols for generating the vapor and having the standard method, I think it's a great idea, because we will be able to compare our results. We will be able to test different products in a different laboratories and compare their relative toxicity. But I think we also need to think about it, that some users might use the product in a certain way. They might generate much more vapor. So having some kind of, you know, what would happen in the really worst for you, we should also be aware about this testing protocols.
That was using the microphone. Sorry, Monique.
Sorry. Just to add to what was just said, it's really important, because there is no standard, and that's a reason. And because there's so many different types of devices and users are using them in multiple different ways, understanding the topography is definitely going to be a step in the direction of getting a standard of how these products, you know, are being used. And then, you know, scientists can reproduce those behaviors in the laboratory. So that's the first step that could be done. There was a review that was just put out in this year by, I'm going to say the name wrong, but it's Somali, and that actually goes over all of the techniques that have been used to date that look at all the volatile cal compounds, all the and everything, and all the different methods that have been used, and you know, how accurate, and you know, the concentrations that have been reported. And by reading through that, it looked like, you know, most of the methods were that were used for a particular compound were in agreement with each other. So there's multiple techniques to do, you know, to study each constituent, but you know, there's multiple ways to get to the same answer. So it's just finding, you know, which one, and all, you know, you're going to get variation within products as well as between products, so you know how you go with that. So it goes back to, you know, the design of them and then the fluids and things like that. So I think that has to be addressed.
Okay.
So I wanted to come back to the presentation that Rob Stevens gave today. And in that presentation, he showed that, you know, Cresta is working on standardized methodologies for testing e-cigarettes. And we have data that shows that, you know, aerosol yields are consistent across different puff profiles. They're consistent across different laboratories. The percentage of nicotine, propylene glycol, and glycerin doesn't change across the device. And that really gets us almost to the answer that we need. We know experimentally that the Cambridge filter pad will trap 99.9% of all of the aerosol that is yielded from the e-cigarette. So we know that with the methodology that we have in place now, especially through Caresta, that we are just about ready to have a standard that doesn't cover volatiles, it doesn't cover carbonyls. My laboratory has our own custom methods that we use. I think probably all the other laboratories have their own custom methods that they're using. But those are very, very trace level compounds. You know, we're looking at 500 milligrams of trapped aerosol versus 15 micrograms of formaldehyde. So it's a very, very trace level of material. We also have methods for propylene oxide. Again, we're down in the part per billion level looking at propylene oxide in e-cigarettes. So it's a very, very different matrix than we see with cigarette smoke with all the compounds. It's a very simple system, and it's really analytically not very challenging if you apply some of the methodology that we've put forward in Caresta.
And I'll put forward a slightly different view. I think standard puffing protocols are great if you're interested in looking at different factors that influence what might come out of the mouth end of a tobacco cigarette or an electronic cigarette in our case, and we used standard puffing protocols in the presentation I showed today. If you're interested in finding out what people are actually likely to get, I think we have a 30 or 40 year history of how bad standard protocols, especially those developed by the tobacco industry, are at misleading us, or actually I should say how good they are at misleading us about what actually humans are exposed to. So if you're interested in predicting what toxicants humans are going to be exposed to when they use an electronic cigarette, we need human puffing profiles. We need to mimic those exactly and then analyze the resulting constituents. Until we do that, we'll probably likely to continue to be misled.
I would actually absolutely disagree with that. All the data that I've collected in my laboratory and I've seen from other studies I've been involved with, it's the puff time that is the most important thing. Puff volume has a minimal effect on aerosol yield. And as long as you can, not e-cigarettes. Oh, certainly cigarettes are totally different, but for e-cigarettes, you have to get the coil hot, and once the coil is hot and there's enough airflow to pull the vapor out, you put a 35 mil puff, a 45 mil puff, a 55 mil puff, or a 70 mil puff. And we've looked at all of those, and while you may see slightly different amounts of aerosol produced in each individual puff, the total amount of aerosol produced across the device is almost exactly the same. And changing the puff profile, going from a bell shape to a square wave, or doing any kind of square wave puff or custom puffs, doesn't change the yield. It's the time, and the longer the coil is on, the more vapor it produces.
So, are you suggesting that 2 2-second puffs each with a minute long interpuff interval is going to lead to the same yield as 2 2-second puffs with a 1 second interpuff interval? Because that's what I mean by puffing profile. I agree with you about square versus non-square, but we're talking about things that go beyond just a single puff.
No. If you haven't allowed enough time for the device to cool down, then no, that wouldn't happen. But in general, when you look at the way people use the devices, they typically will allow the device to cool down.
No, I don't. I have not seen data that's.
I can say that my studies on puffing topography, some published, some not yet published. And let me make a comment on the previous session. There are devices for 2 years now which can measure and can record puffing topography. We have these devices.
We got 1 minute left, yeah. And I have two
okay.
to speak.
So the topography shows that, yes, I agree with Thomas. Probably they don't wait until it is completely cooled down. The device needs approximately 1 minute to cool down, but we are seeing that the interpuff interval is around 30 seconds, 25, 35, something like that.
Just one comment. I think because we are talking now about the studies on the vapor and studies in the laboratory with the smoking machine and et cetera. And I did the studies and I agree this is very important, but this cannot be only the one standard for evaluating the products. We need to look at the alternative approaches. There are studies with the cell line, studies with the animals, studies with the users actually. We cannot just rely on the studies with the smoking machine. It was done before and it has a tremendous negative effect on the public health. And we cannot repeat the same error one more time.
Cliff.
So we're running out of time?
Yes, you have it, and I'm going to ask anybody else before we close up, but you got time.
So very quickly, the analytical technologies to measure the levels in e-cigarettes I think are out there or are close enough or can be adapted. As has been mentioned, I agree with everybody on the panel here pretty much. The standard smoking protocols, particularly for cigarettes, can be adapted. Something like Caresta proposed and would be useful, not for measuring exposure, but for comparing, differences in device and device design. I mean, ultimately, we need, for devices that are currently on the market, as these products evolve, we want to be careful that we don't lock ourselves into some sort of rigid standard that won't be applicable as we move down the road. And also, I think, as also mentioned, I mean, that is useful. What we really need is some sort of, from a population standpoint, is looking at biomarkers of exposure to sort of assess what's really happening in people as opposed to what's happening in the laboratory when we're trying to sort of get an idea of what the chemistry looks like.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
So I think I left out part of my argument. So one of the beautiful things about e-cigarettes is you can weigh them. And so using a machine to mimic people is kind of, it's nonsense. If you give a smoker an e-cigarette, they can use it for half an hour, they can use it for a day. You can weigh it and find out exactly how much nicotine they took in just by a difference of weight. And so trying to model that on a machine is not something I think is feasible. You just weigh it. And you can do that with different puff profiles, different devices, all kinds of different things, and you can videotape them while they do it, and you know exactly how much nicotine they've actually delivered to themselves.
Okay, Tom.
Yeah, well, while we're on the subject of nonsense, how does that, if you're interested in formaldehyde, not nicotine yield, and formaldehyde isn't in the liquid but is generated by the puffing, then how are you going to be able to get that from the weight?
Well, I mean, one of the things you'd have to do then is you'd have to see if there's a different amount of formaldehyde produced by different puffs. And we've seen some differences, but the differences are minor.
Okay. Thank you. That was good. Getting active participation. Thank you so very much for all of the speakers. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, you guys, you have to go back there now. Okay, so our next speaker had a scheduling conflict for tomorrow, so we're very grateful that he could be here today. We will be talking about packaging more tomorrow, but today Dr. Boha will be speaking about child-resistant packaging.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'd like to thank the organizers for accommodating my schedules. I won't be in town tomorrow. I'm an employee of the Consumer Product Safety Commission. We're a small federal independent agency, and as a result, I do not have any financial interest in the products being discussed. I should also mention that as an employee of the Consumer Product Safety Commission, the comments that I expressed today are those of my own and not have been reviewed nor approved by the views of the commission. The CPSC administers the Poison Prevention Packaging Act and its implementing regulations at 16 CFR 1700. The purpose of the act is to prevent children from any serious personal injury or illness resulting from handling, using, ingesting a hazardous household substance. Household substances are defined as things that are customarily produced, distributed for sale, for consumption, for use, or customarily stored in or about the household and are a hazardous substance as defined by the Federal Hazardous Substances Act, as defined by the Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act, the FDCA, or substances that are intended for use as a fuel that are stored in a portable container used in the heating, cooking, or refrigeration systems of a home. The term package means the immediate container or wrapping for any household substance that is used or consumed or stored in or about the household. So that would mean what is actually touching the drug. So if you had a special package that was not child resistant and you were to put it inside a medicine vial that was child resistant, that would be illegal as far as the Consumer Product Safety Commission is concerned because it's not the immediate packaging. In order for a substance to be regulated by the commission, the degree or nature of the hazard to children and the availability of such substance must be such that special packaging is required to protect children from serious injury resulting from the handling, using, or ingesting of such a substance. Special packaging must be technically feasible, it must be practicable, and it must be appropriate. That means that it must be able to be manufactured using modern mass production means. It means that it must be not primarily, it doesn't need to be on the market today, but it can be made on the market in the near future. Special packaging is something that is designed or constructed to significantly difficult for children under the age of 5 to open or obtain a toxic amount within a reasonable amount of time and not difficult for normal adults to use. One of my pet peeves is when people childproof packaging, and that's not true. You give a child enough time and they will figure out how to get into it. I can guarantee it. Contrary to popular belief, childproof packaging is designed to be opened by adults, not by children, although at times it may seem that way. Nothing in the Act shall authorize the Commission from specifying specific package designs. We can't tell a manufacturer what type of special packaging to use. We can specify that they use some type of special packaging, but we can't say you have to be in unit dose or you have to be in a vial. We can't do that. We cannot specify product content or package quantity. So there's nothing that would tell us, that allows us to say, you know, putting 1,000 counts in a vial is not a good idea. You should put 50 in there. Congress does not give us that ability. There are a number of drugs that are included in 16 CFR 1700.14A. They're listed here. I'm not going to go through them. The most recent drug that was added to this list was imidazolines. that are commonly used in decongestants, both orally and ocularly. There's another number of substances that are required to be in special packaging, and they are listed here. The exceptions are products that are not used in or about a household. Those that would be used in institutional use. We do not require special packaging for medications that are used in hospitals or in nursing homes. We don't require special packaging for those products that are bona fide professional products. A professional product is one that is limited to use in the trade industry. So a manufacturer cannot put industrial strength cleaner on a product and then sell it in Home Depot or another store. And by the way, that's not an endorsement for said store. Prescription drugs, if they're bulk drugs that are intended to be repackaged by a pharmacist, are not required to be in special packaging because the pharmacist then would be putting it in special packaging. They have to be requested for a patient or a physician. So as a consumer, you have the right to request non-special packaging for your prescription medications, or your physician may prescribe it to be in non-special packaging because he or she may perceive that you would have difficulty using special packaging. And then there are a number of drugs that are exempted. Some of these drugs are exempted because there's lack of toxicity, say with the oral hormone replacement therapy medications, and others because there is an immediate need to use a drug, say some of the sublingual nitrites that you would use. It may take a consumer additional time to open that special packaging, and that time may factor into the significant illness for the patient. Over-the-counter drugs, there is a one-size exception. The commission has taken the stance that there are people with significant illnesses or disabilities, and they could not properly use special packaging. Therefore, we allow manufacturers to use one size, not their most popular selling size, say a pain reliever such as aspirin, which is a regulated substance, in a 50, a 75, and a 100 count size. They can specify one of those count sizes to be in non-special packaging. That size cannot be their most popular selling size, and it must be labeled either with the statement that this package is not intended for children this package is intended for households without young children, or package not child resistant. Again, the rule was set up to be the exception, not the norm. Other popular sizes must be in special packaging, and there are certain products that we have determined must be in special packaging, one of which is drain cleaners. If you can't use the special packaging on a drain cleaner, you probably shouldn't be messing around with drain cleaner in the first place. That's my opinion, not the commission's. We have a number of test methods. There's a child test. It's done with panels of 50 children. There's a tester restriction, so we do not get a tester bias. There's a site restriction, again, so we get a non-stratified sample. We don't want all the children coming from a given socioeconomic group because they live in this one neighborhood, so we have a site restriction. We have the tester restriction. The test consists of a child they're tested in groups of two. Each child is given a package. They are asked to open it. The children will do whatever they do as long as it's not disruptive. After the 5 minutes, the package is removed from them, and the tester opens it in front of them, much like a parent would open a package in front of their own children. There's no overt actions, and they're not said, okay, they're not told, if you wish, you know, push tab A here and turn it, that's how you open it. It's just open normally. If the child has not used their teeth to help in, or assist them in opening the package, they are told that they may use their teeth if they wish. There are certain package designs that if a child were to stick it in their mouth and use their teeth, much like a pair of vice grips, they can open a package. They are then tested for another 5 minutes, and there's a pass-fail table that I'll show you on the next slide that would determine whether or not that package passed after the first panel or if they would need to continue with another panel. There is a total of 200 children tested. That's a panel, four panels of 50. A pass rate must be a minimum of 80% successful after 200 children are tested. If you see with the on the first panel of 50, the pass rate here is 90%. So this was statistically determined that as you test more children, the pass rates decrease somewhat, as I said, to a minimum of 80% successful. Unit packaging is slightly different. The commission has determined that because unlike a bottle, when you open a bottle, you're gained access to everything. With unit packaging, if you open a unit, you've gained access to a pill. So a test failure with unit packaging is the number of units that a child gains access to that would cause serious personal harm or injury to that child. So if you've got a fairly toxic drug, staff uses the jargon of that package would be assigned an F level of 1 or a failure unit of 1, where opening of a single unit would cause a failure. Where on the other hand, if you had a relatively non-toxic unit, a child could open as many as 8 units before a failure would occur. If a child were to open 9 units of a F8 drug, that would be considered a failure. Another big difference with unit packaging is, unlike that we saw with other packaging types, you cannot market a non-child resistant unit package. They all have to be child resistant. You can't label away the obligation of being in child resistant packaging by taking a unit package and saying this package is not child resistant when it is indeed required to be in special packaging. A senior test, it differs from the child test in the fact that there is a single panel of 100 adults. This testing is put in place because if a senior cannot open a package within a given amount of time, they are not going to properly use that packaging. They will dump the contents into a baggie, or they'll just take a piece of saran wrap and a rubber band and put it over the top of the container if they cannot open that package. So, as we saw with the child test, there is a site restriction. There is a tester restriction. Unlike the child test, the seniors are given 5 minutes to open a package. If they successfully open that package, they are given an identical package, and now they are given 1 minute to open that package. The thought being they have already learned how to open that properly, that package properly, and if they cannot open it within 1 minute, they are not going to use that packaging because it's too difficult. If a senior cannot open that package, they're given two conventional packages that have dissimilar opening types, a snap top and a regular twist off, and they're asked to open those packages. If they can't open that package, they're eliminated from the test because if they can't open a conventional package, there is no way they're going to open special packaging. A 90% effectiveness level is required for the senior test. Metal cans and closures generally are not used by elderly adults. We use our traditional test. This was a test way back when the FDA actually had the CPSE was part of the FDA at one time, and the test then was with 18 and 45-year-olds. Physician samples are required to be in special packaging, but since they, well, they would be required to be in special packaging if it were not for the fact that a physician is dispensing the drug. Since the PPPA allows prescription drugs to be dispensed in non-prescription form, a physician, since they are acting both as a prescriber and as the person dispensing the drug, they can dispense physician samples in non-special packaging. Section 4 does not apply to OTC drugs, so if a physician gives you an over-the-counter medication, it has to be in special packaging. And if you recall a few years back, there were a number of recalls from toys. Congress responded by implementing the Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act. The Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act requires that any product that is subject to a rule or regulation that is implemented by the Commission, they must issue a certificate stating that the product has been tested and meets all applicable CPSC rules. Special packaging is required to be products that require special packaging that is a rule, so they must issue a certificate stating that their product is indeed meets the special packaging requirements. Well, I thank you. We have more information on our webpage here, and our contact information, or my contact information, along with other members of staff, are available here, as well as our director, Mary Toro. Thank you.
Are there any questions that you would, anyone would like to ask Dr. Boha, since he won't be able to be here tomorrow for our panel? Did you do a card, ma'am? I'm sorry? Go back one slide, sure. Any other questions? The slides are not available, which is why it'd be good to don't have any questions. Okay. Thank you so very much. Thank you. I also make another correction, too. I had said that bios were outside. They're not. So if you want to know anybody's bio, Google is a good way to go, or you can come up and ask us, okay? So we have a break for 15 minutes. Please stretch your legs, walk around a bit, and come back in 15 minutes. Thank you so very much.